For there is nothing heavier than compassion. Not even one's own pain weighs so heavy as the pain one feels with someone, for someone, a pain intensified by the imagination and prolonged by 100 echoes.
Hi folks, and welcome to the PAX podcast. The P stands for Philos, or friend, and the X stands for Sinos, or stranger. For the next little bit, we're going to challenge what we know, explore what we don't know, and hopefully find ourselves a bit more informed than we were before. My name is Mette Skorup, and along with Karina Vogelsberger, I study peace and conflict studies. We will be your guides for this podcast, with help from our lovely narrator, Jan McGaslin. Today we're going to talk about empathy. We'll discuss different views and theories. What is empathy and why do we have it? Is it necessary for morality? Can you have too much of it? To find out more about how empathy works in practice, we'll talk to Matthew McClure, who's a Canadian journalist, and Kerstin Karlström, who works for the UNHCR in Lebanon. We're also going to venture into some of the darker sides of empathy, or perhaps the lack of empathy, such as the infamous Milgram experiment. So put on your running shoes or make yourself a nice cup of tea and get comfortable while we dive in.
In a speech from 2006, President Obama spoke in ominous phrases about the empathy deficit.
You know, there's a lot of talk in this country about the federal deficit. And I think it's important for us to talk about that, but I think we should talk more about another deficit, what I call the empathy deficit. The ability to put ourselves in somebody else's shoes, to see the world through those who are different from us. The child who's hungry, the laid-off steel worker, the immigrant woman who's cleaning up your dorm room.
But what do we really mean when we talk about empathy? The social philosopher and author of Empathy, Why It Matters and How to Get It, Roman Kiersnarek, defines empathy as the ability to step into the shoes of another person, aiming to understand their feelings and perspectives, and to use that understanding to guide our action. That makes it different from kindness or pity. Another definition is an emotion that is congruent with, but not necessarily identical to, the emotion of another individual. Empathy is a contested concept, and there is no one definition. Some distinguish clearly between empathy, sympathy, and physical mimicry, while others let the notions bleed into another.
The word itself stems from the Greek pathos, which means emotion or feeling. But the intellectual use of the word can be traced back to the late 1800s, when the German word Einfühlung, meaning infeeling, was introduced. The German philosopher Theodor Lipps used Einfühlung to describe the tendency humans have of mimicking or mirroring physical gestures and expressions others are making. At the same time, you evoke in yourself the feeling that you normally associate with this gesture, and then you project that back onto the other, creating an interpersonal understanding between the two of you. Lipps argued that since we only have experiential access to our own feelings, we have to rely on these in order to try and understand the feelings of others. Some would suggest that this process of mirroring is basic to human nature and that it's key to feeling oneself into the emotional lives of others. Phenomenologists like Husserl and Scheler, though, would argue that what Lipps is describing is merely motor mimicry or emotional contagion, that is, catching someone else's feelings.
There seems to be different views. Does this feeling of empathy entail taking upon yourself the feelings, joys, or pains of the other? Or does it merely require using your moral imagination to imagine what it would be like to see the world through the other's eyes without necessarily feeling his or her feelings yourself? What most can agree on is that there are two kinds of empathy, the emotional or affective, and the cognitive empathy. Daniel Goleman, psychologist and author of the book Emotional Intelligence, explains that affective empathy, or emotional contagion, is to physically feel someone else's feelings. For example, you see a person crying and you respond by feeling, quote-unquote, their sadness too. According to social neuroscience, this response depends largely on our mirror neuron system. Mirror neurons are small circuits of cells that are activated both when we perform a certain action and when we see someone else performing the same action. That means whether you smile or scratch your arm, or you see someone else smile or scratch their arm, the same neurons will light up. Neuroscientist Christian Kasers explains that neuroscience shows this process to be richer than the idea of affective empathy. Quote, "So if you see me grasp a cool glass of water, you share my intention to grasp the glass, what it feels like to grasp the glass, the cool sensation in my fingers, and my satisfaction as I feel my thirst being quenched." End quote. Cognitive empathy, also called perspective taking, is knowing how the other person feels and what they might be thinking. Kasers calls this process mentalizing. Roman Kiersnarek argues that this ability is important for understanding each other and for building meaningful relationships. While Daniel Coleman does not disagree with this, he points out that cognitive empathy does not necessarily come paired with kindness. Sociopaths, narcissists, and torturers can be skilled at perspective taking while completely lacking in sympathy. This brings us to the difference between sympathy and empathy.
The German philosopher Max Scheler explains sympathy with the following thought experiment. In the first scenario, you see a crying child, but instead of seeing distress, you just see a series of facial distortions. This reaction would be considered pathological. In the second scenario, you see the child's face as emotionally expressive, but without feeling any compassion. And in the last scenario, you respond to the crying child with compassion or concern. According to Sheila, the last example counts as a case of sympathy, also called pity or kindness. But, he argues, in order to feel sympathy, you first have to understand that the child is suffering, and this realization might be brought about by empathy. To Sheila then, empathy is, quote, a basic understanding of expressive others, quote, while sympathy adds concern and care on top of this. While we could continue discussing the exact definition of empathy, we'll move on and try to make some sense of why we have it.
The primatologist, Franz de Waal, says that empathy is a basic to the human species and points to the fact that it emerges very early in life. He argues that it was necessary for our ancestors' survival because, one, we need to care for the needs of our offspring, and two, we, as a species, depend on cooperation. Thus, we do better as a group when we have healthy and capable groupmates, which means taking care of each other is, in Waal's words, just a matter of enlightened self-interest. Recent studies confirm that human beings are made for cooperation and mutual aid, and empathy drives us towards it. Most argue that when you empathize with others, you are more likely to help them.
However, psychologists and social scientists alike admit that our compassion has limits. One example is illustrated by the Milgram experiment. Yale professor and social psychologist Stanley Milgram became fascinated by the question of why millions of people took part in the Holocaust. In his search for an explanation, Milgram conducted what voluntary participants thought was a memory study. The volunteers were divided into learners and teachers. They were physically introduced before starting, but were separated during the experiment. Teachers were told to administer electric shocks to the learner whenever they failed to remember the correct words, and for every mistake, the shock became stronger. In reality, the learner was part of the study and the shocks weren't real, but the teachers, of course, didn't notice.
Throughout the experiment, instructors dressed like scientists in white long coats firmly instructed participants to continue, and even though they showed extreme discomfort in doing so, most followed these commands. To Milgram's dismay, about 65% of people went all the way to the highest level of shock, 450 volts, labeled XXX. Because of this, his main conclusion was that authority has an extremely strong impact on human action, maybe even stronger than that of empathy or compassion. Another explanation, though, could be distance or the physical separation of the two subjects. Horrified by Milgram's results, different researchers have replicated the experiment, and some of their studies relativize the initial findings, although they reaffirm that people are very likely to follow the instructions of perceived authorities. The likelihood of people's participation decreases by more than 30% when they can physically see the person they are supposed to be giving shocks to.
Historian Rick Schenkman, in his latest book Political Animals, draws on biology to explain this phenomenon. While Schenkman doesn't dismiss the idea that empathy is inherent to human beings, he argues that, from an evolutionary perspective, it developed in the context of small-scale communities. People, so the assumption, are only capable of sustaining meaningful human relations within small, intimate groups of about 150 people, a frame today's globalized and interconnected world clearly overstretches. So you can show empathy for people in your immediate neighborhood, but what if things happen somewhere abroad? In a country you may have even difficulty finding on a map. In a recent article, Schenkman recalls how US Senator Ted Cruz's approval ratings went up after he suggested carpet bombing ISIS in Syria during the last Republican presidential debate. War, conducted in the form of bombings or drone strikes abroad, appears to make people much less attentive to its humanitarian costs.
But not only geographical distance can make us less likely to show empathy for the other. Schenkman alerts us that we have much more difficulties to put ourselves into the shoes of people who are different to us or of lower social status, where we feel greater empathy for people of higher status. This is not a conscious act. Our brain distinguishes automatically between people that are helpful to us and people who are seemingly useless. If a person is categorized as helpful, our brain quickly goes into a state of hyperattentiveness. If not, the brain sets our body back into a model of relaxation. In order to justify our ignorance towards other people's suffering to ourselves, we rely on abstractions. Frequently, we try to dehumanize the other, for example, by talking about collateral damage rather than civilian casualties. And here we arrive at the heart of the debate. Is empathy necessary for morality? What are the arguments for and against? Karina and Mede sat down for discussion on empathy.
We tried to make sense of these current debates, but Mede, probably we have to start off with defining what we mean by moral judgment.
Well, morality is difficult because you can talk about it in a descriptive way, where it's a certain set of codes that a group has decided upon, or you can use it normatively to refer to a code of conduct that, given specified conditions, would be put forward by all rational persons. The debate, of course, goes very much on whether you need empathy to be a moral person or if empathy can even be a hindrance to morality.
And I feel like the first position corresponds pretty well with what Roman Krisznaric is saying, because while he argues that empathy is indeed something inherent to us, and probably the same applies to moral judgment, he also proposes that we can and should train our capacity to empathize with the other. He seems to assume that this would guide us to a better sense of morality and enable us to act in a way that is not only to the benefit of ourselves, but also to the one of the other. And it can prevent us from acting only on the basis of our own largely selfish aspirations.
Then we have someone like Paul Bloom that argues against empathy, but he says, quote, "I'm not against morality, compassion, kindness, love, being a good neighbor, doing the right thing, and making the world a better place. My claim is actually the opposite. If you want to be good and do good, empathy is a poor guide," quote. And he means that empathy is a poor guide for social policies because it's subject to so many biases. And he says empathy is narrow and empathy is insensitive to big numbers and data, meaning that we would empathize more with the one person in the single story that we can relate to than big numbers that would affect a lot more people.
But I feel like there are quite some examples that one could hold against this argument. Take the work of industrial designer Patricia Moore, for example. Moore tried to simulate the physical constraints elderly people are dealing with in order to find out how they experience daily life. She therefore masked herself as an 80-year-old woman and took on props and glasses that made it harder for her to move. And so then she went off to 116 cities to explore the various challenges people are facing. Later on, she incorporated this newly gained perspective in her work as industrial designer. Many of Moore's innovations became meanwhile standardized and institutionalized. So in her case, by trying to put herself into the other shoes, Moore has strongly contributed to a more inclusionary public sphere.
I think that's a wonderful story, but I guess she could have used her cognition and her rationality to come to the same results.
I'm not sure if like pure rationality would be enough, but obviously, I mean, she could have also done interviews with elderly people or so, which raises then the question if that would have required a sense of empathy as well, or solely rational thinking and the ability to translate the input from her interviews into practical innovations. And, you know, even if she used her ability to emphasize in this experiment, how will we ever know if her experience was even close to that of elderly people? I mean, her disabilities were only temporary, and maybe she struggled with certain things more than someone else would have done in this situation.
I think that hits on something very important for this discussion, whether you can ever really feel someone else's feelings or really experience their world, which is also what Theodor Lips is talking about with Einfühlung, that we can only ever relate to other people through our own feelings and that empathy is always going to be self-reflexive. So maybe we can only try to understand other people and listen to them, but we can't ever feel their feelings.
Yeah, that reminds me on the concept of empathic listening. That's something Marshall Rosenberg brought up. Rosenberg is basically the founder of the so-called nonviolent communication process. And he doesn't suggest that we will ever be able to really feel or think the same as another person, but he says that a critical tool to get close to this experience and thus develop an understanding of the other side's views and actions is to actively listen to our interlocutor. That means to not only give the other person the room to speak, but to be really attentive to the feelings and needs he or she articulates. So thereby one should refrain from trying to make connections to one's own life, which would only lead to preoccupation with oneself, rather than fostering a better understanding of the other person. Something that would be crucial to avoid and also resolve mutual conflict.
And I think if we go back to Professor Paul Bloom, as he says, he's not against compassion. He just distinguishes between this, what he calls empathy, putting yourself in someone's shoes, and what he calls compassion, which is trying to understand the other person's problems, but without mirroring their feelings. And this empathic listening, I would put in a category of compassion. One example that I thought about with this empathic listening is what is called, well, referred to as the Boston Miracle. It was in the early 90s, and Reverend Jeffrey Brown has a really great TED Talk about this. He was one of the ministers in this 10-point coalition, which was a coalition of ministers that helped patrol dangerous streets in Boston where gangs and gang members would be around at night and the police didn't want to patrol. And in doing this, the ministers in this 10-point coalition, they actually talked to the gang members, employing their, what you could call their empathic listening. Mm-hmm. And Brown talks about being surprised at the level of sensitivity and reflection and intelligence he found in these young people, which, you know, helped to eradicate some of his own biases. And then through actually talking to these young people, they came up with a program that was a cooperation between the communities, the ministers, churches, and the police, where the gang members were offered opportunities to educate themselves rather than just being arrested.
Yeah, that's definitely a good example for that. But it brings me to the point, and that's probably another question, of whether you could also have too much empathy in such situations.
Well, you know, Bloom does talk about having too much empathy in the sense that you feel too much of someone else's pain. He talks about how high feelings of empathy can lead to what he calls empathetic distress.
Yeah, but interestingly, that reminds me again on a public lecture by Roman Krisnerich, where he was explicitly asked of whether people could also end up having too much empathy. And yeah, he indeed admitted that there might be a form of empathic overarousal, which affects especially professionals. when they're dealing with other people suffering in their job or like more frequently. However, he says then that people could develop a capacity to distance themselves from direct suffering by switching from affective to cognitive empathy. So that means taking up the perspective of the other, but avoiding to evoke a too strong emotional attachment. This understanding seems to be not very different from what Bloom calls compassion, despite using, in fact, the opposite terminology.
I think that's very true, and a lot of the debate actually can be boiled down to whether we call something one thing or another, whether we call it compassion or empathy or affective or cognitive empathy. And it seems that Roman Krisnarek, who argues for empathy, and Paul Bloom, who argues against empathy, in fact, do agree on the approach that we should take, but they call it different things. There's also the other end of the spectrum, the opposite of empathic overarousal, which could be called compassion fatigue, where you're so exposed to other people's pain and suffering that in the end you become numb. I think basically we can just agree that there's lots of different opinions and definitions about this topic, and maybe a reason that there's so much written on it and so much research done is that it's such a basic component of being a human being.
And I think that just led to a broad spectrum of terminologies as well and definitions.
After a theoretical discussion, we had the pleasure of talking to Matthew McClure, who's a Canadian journalist. In his long career, he has worked for Al Jazeera and CTV, amongst others, in diverse locations such as India, Pakistan, Nepal, Iraq, and Afghanistan. So, Matt, first off, could you introduce yourself, please?
I'm Matt McClure, and I'm a Canadian journalist who has spent, I guess, 9 years overseas covering conflicts and disasters, primarily in Asia.
What are some of your most interesting stories, well, from your long career as a journalist, but especially from working overseas?
Well, I mean, I guess I was thinking of the context of what we were talking about and empathy. And, you know, I was on Christmas vacation in Burma with my family when the tsunami hit in 2003. And I was asked to go first to Sri Lanka and then to India to cover that disaster and its aftermath. And one of the images that sticks in my mind was, in a village in South India, a couple days after the tsunami had hit, and I met a woman who was there with her children, but also the children of her former neighbors. She had lost everything, including her husband, and she had also was caring for these children of her neighbors' children because both of them had been killed. And I remember her attempting to hand over to me this baby, this infant that was her neighbor's. She'd asked me, please take this child because I can't care for it as well as my own children. In that instance, I mean, I had my job. My job was to explain to Canadians or explain to the world what had happened here. But you also have, I guess, an additional duty as a human being.
You're talking about this dilemma between being a moral human being and a professional. I was wondering what responsibility you feel. Well, first of all, that the media has in a conflict, and also what responsibility you think you have as a human being working as a journalist.
When covering a conflict or a disaster, the way I look at it is I have a duty to explain what has happened and to place it in a larger context of facts. But the other thing is that I understand the first thing I have to do is I have to have people care. If they don't care, they're not listening, they're not watching. And in order to get to that place, you have to be emotionally involved with the story. So you have to see it and touch it, and you have to feel it yourself. So that means when you're talking to victims of wars or disasters, you have to look them in the eyes, and you have to, on a certain level, feel what they're feeling. It also provokes an emotional response within myself that allows me to tell that story in a powerful way. it's a bit of, you have to care and you have to show them that you care, but you can't care too much, or else you might collapse in a fit of tears or something like that, and not be able to go on and finish what you needed to do that day. After a roadside bombing in Afghanistan, you know, I'd be there talking to a family within minutes of it having happened, and they're crying, and you do care. I do care when I'm in those moments, but you're also acting on a certain level.
Do you feel like your own feelings of empathy or compassion have ever been a hindrance in your work?
I don't normally think of it as a hindrance, no. I mean, I think it's a necessary ingredient. If you don't care, it's impossible to create, you know, a story that's going to make other people care. I mean, I think you also have to be able to pull back from the whole thing and place whatever it is this person has experienced, to place it in some context. The cultural differences that may, and fear that may exist in the society, and norms that may exist in a society that results in these sorts of attacks.
This fear that you're talking about, I think, is something we've increasingly seen the media capitalize on. How do you think we need to try to obtain a sensible balance between catching people's attention and playing to their emotions, but also having the rationality and the facts in order?
Well, I mean, I guess as a journalist, I mean, I guess I'm always asking myself, I believe very much in telling the story of an individual or of a family is the key to doing powerful journalism. But I mean, I've always, you know, tried to, you know, look at the larger picture and to try to answer the question in the story as to what extent is this, you know, representative of a larger issue or a larger problem. And to the extent that, you know, the specific represents the general, then I think that's what good journalism is. It's hard. I mean, because we all come with biases that we've grown up with about what's right and what's wrong, our beliefs and thoughts about how society ought to be, and those inevitably show up in our work. So what to do?
Yes, I think that is always the question. You know, especially in the context of empathy, we've read stuff by researchers who claim that sometimes empathy can almost be dangerous and it can be a liability because of the biases that we bring to the table.
Yeah, I suppose. Fundamentally, I mean, you come at all of this with your journalistic training and experience, which tells you that whatever you're going to report needs to be based on the facts, that there may be, you know, different perspectives and views on the situation, and you need to have some sort of balance of those in your story so that it's not just one perspective. But the thing is that particularly, I think, when it comes to foreign reporting, when you're, you know, explaining to a Western or North American audience something that has happened on the other side of the world, you need to have them relate and care. And it's a challenge. You really have a duty to place these events and this pathos in some sort of historical and cultural context. I think you have a duty to help them feel, but also understand.
How much do you take into consideration when you're writing a story and you're doing reporting how the audience might react? For example, in a conflict like Syria, we're so overexposed to it and people suffer from this compassion fatigue. How do you try to combat that?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know the answer to that one. One of the ways, you know, that I sometimes look at journalism when you're dealing with this issue of compassion fatigue, which is real, is you sometimes look for an everyman character. So in the aftermath of the disaster in Sri Lanka, it might be a Canadian aid organization that's there trying to help. And so you talk to them and you have them share their perspective on the situation and see what's happened through their eyes, which is, I guess, it might be easier for someone back home to relate. If the viewers and the audience can have an everyman in this terrible disaster or this war, sometimes they care more.
I was watching this documentary about Fidel Castro, and they were discussing this journalist who had a habit of falling in love with the characters and the causes that he'd portray. Is this this lack of filter and distance something that you've seen in other journalists throughout your career?
I think, you know, it can happen. The media likes underdogs, and it likes people who are good clip, right? They like people who are good talkers and are characters. But, I mean, I think we all need to be, you know, on guard when we're talking about them. Whether it's, you know, Donald Trump, or whether it's someone like Narendra Modi, who is now the Prime Minister of India. We need to be careful in making sure that the public understands who these people are and the ideas, sometimes the dangerous ideas that they represent. I mean, some people are talking about this discussion that's going on in the aftermath of this U.S. election about whether we exist in a post-truth society. And I guess, what can I say? I fundamentally disagree. There are facts out there. There is a way of assembling data that can show us what is happening broadly. And it's our duty to ground, you know, the discussion and our journalism in the truth. That's our role and responsibility as journalists, and we can never abdicate that.
So Matthew seems to be opposed to the idea of a so-called post-truth era, as it is frequently discussed these days. And while having a sense of empathy is certainly necessary for the work as a journalist, it does not preclude the need of some kind of professional distance. We were wondering whether people in the humanitarian aid and development sector would agree with this view. To find out more, we talked to Kerstin Karlstrom, Senior Interagency Officer for the UNHCR in Lebanon. Kerstin, do you maybe want to start by telling us a bit more about your work?
Sure. My job is to coordinate between the different UN agencies to make sure that we all speak with one voice. And I work with the government and also the NGOs that are working in Lebanon to develop the Lebanon Crisis Response Plan, which is one plan that outlines what all of the different organizations are going to do in support of the government to manage the refugee situation in the country.
So since the topic of our podcast is empathy, in the context of humanitarian aid, some argue that having too much empathy can also have a negative impact on one's work as a professional. What's your thought on that? Do such considerations even play a role in your daily work?
I think we do talk about that a lot, actually. And what's the, I mean, perhaps not using exactly the same terminology, but we do talk a lot about how to stay objective while still showing compassion and how to plan and manage our programs accordingly. Because it's not, when you work at this large scale that we're doing here, it's very different to working for a small charity, for example. If you're in a small charity where you're helping a few individuals that you get to know personally, that's different to if you're working the way the UN often does, large scale with governments to create systems that help tens of thousands of people. But with that said, I would hate to say that empathy is completely eliminated from what we do, because, I mean, basically, what we do is create social service systems, right? And to make a good social service system, you need to really understand and feel what the beneficiaries or what your people of concern are experiencing. Yeah. So I wouldn't eliminate it completely, but certainly there's a certain amount of needing to keep a distance and keep to a bigger picture and to create systems that will outlive us as individuals. Because if it's based on me and what I do, when I move on to another operation, to another office, all of those things will change, and they can't. So everything has to be done with a very long-term perspective. For that reason, it has to be created from a much more objective point of view.
Well, that seems to be pretty much in line with what social psychologist Paul Bloom is saying, because he argues that empathy can be more of a hindrance to appropriate action. if understood as taking up other people's suffering. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, no, I mean, I'm sure that's it. If you are responding to one individual, yes, then that's very different. But when you're working large scale, it's you have to remain professional because you cannot help each and every individual. And if you take on each and every one of those needs and you kind of feel the pain for the 1 million individuals, to make those decisions becomes very difficult.
Yeah. Though maybe on the contrary, there's also this argument that an overemphasis on impartiality and keeping a professional distance can lead to a kind of blindness towards the context in which one is operating. The discussion does thereby not only focus on the term empathy as such, but also on the concept of compassion.
Yeah, no, absolutely. But I would differentiate between, without perhaps getting too theoretical, that feeling compassion for the situation and trying to understand is very different from a deeper definition of empathy. But I think everything always has to be contextualized. Of course, there's a large amount of understanding the people that we are supposed to help, but that there are also very different layers in doing that, that you'll have organizations that are really based out in the field, in the communities, who meet people every single day and who tend to their very immediate needs and hear from them and live close to them. And there your level of identifying with the situation is going to be much higher and has to be much higher because you have to understand who it is you're talking to face every day. Whereas if you are working for a very big organization whose job it is to sit inside government offices, the type of engagement you have is going to require a different level of professionalism. But certainly there has to be a level of understanding the people or you cannot work all over the world. I gave the example that I'd worked in the Somali camps in the north of Kenya, and now I'm working with Syrian refugees in Lebanon. And the hosting countries are completely different. The backgrounds of the refugees are completely different. So there's certainly an amount of needing to understand who they are and what they need and why they need it.
Considering that you are somewhat in between the higher political level and the people working in the refugee camps, do you sometimes experience some kind of tensions between these two groups?
Every day. Every day. This is one of the difficulties we face really on a daily basis, even within the same organization, where, for example, the things I do daily is literally to talk to a lot of organizations, to understand what all those organizations are doing, to be able to monitor that what they are doing is efficient, that we're working effectively, etc. That to someone who every day goes out into a tent and talks to families seems like an utter waste of time. And I can understand that. Of course it is. At the same time, if we are unable to track what we're doing, why we're doing it, and how much money we're spending on doing it, we will not receive any more funding from big donors. We will also not be able to justify our existence to the government, who will say, why are you all here in our country? So, yes, there is a constant kind of debate and battle between these different layers.
Are there any mechanisms in place in order to deal with or prevent such situations?
There is a coordination structure in place, which involves a number of different working groups that meet on a regular basis. And this structure, this coordination structure, starts at the very, very top, including ministers and high-level UN officials and country directors of NGOs and so on, all the way down to the field level, which involves community leaders and field workers and UN and NGO staff in the field. So there are many layers of these types of working groups where we share experiences, what we've seen, what we know, what we've done to address it, what results we achieve, and that kind of feeds through a hierarchy of reporting. So it goes from the bottom all the way up to the top. The struggle is always to get the top layer all the way down to the bottom again, because it tends to get diluted, that it's a lot easier to take something very concrete and practical that has been discussed in a community field meeting and share that up. And this is my very personal opinion, that people tend to have an easier time to understand that I went into a family and I saw something really sad or something that we need to address. And I can then report that up, and it becomes a very individual and practical thing that we need to solve. And that goes all the way up the hierarchy. It's a lot harder to take a massively political discussion at the level of a minister and bring that down and make sure that it's understood by the people in the communities and in the tents. I'm not trying to say that the political decision is always correct. Of course, it can be massively wrong, and it can be massively wrong in an aid situation as well. But it is often difficult to translate that highest level of discussion. Also, we spend a lot of time creating these structures.
We have almost reached the end of our journey. What are the lessons we can draw from all of this? There seems to be a broad consensus that empathy is inherent to human beings and that it was probably developed as a tool of survival. But empathy can be deceptive. It's sensitive to biases and preconceived notions, while it is insensitive to large numbers and data. We've learned that, to Matthew McClure, empathy is a necessary component of good journalism, but that you also need to be capable of taking a step back and understanding the big picture. To Kerstin Karlström, it is important to balance one's sense of empathy with an understanding of the larger picture. And while aid work on the ground requires a higher level of emotional attachment than on the organizational level, both perspectives have to be taken into account. In the end, all the thinkers we've encountered in this episode agree that some level of compassion and mutual understanding is important. Important for building meaningful social relations and for creating a strong sense of identity and belonging.
We want to thank Matthew McClure, Kerstin Karlström, Jan McAslan, and Northwestern University. And thank you for listening to the PAX podcast.